Centesimus Annus to his venerable brothers, in the episcopate the priests and deacons, families of men and women religious, all the Christian faithful, and to all men and women of good will on the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. Blessing. Venerable brothers, beloved sons and daughters, health, and the apostolic blessing. Introduction. 1. The centenary of the promulgation of the encyclical, which begins with the words, Rerum Novarum, won by my predecessor of venerable memory Pope Leo XIII, is an occasion of great importance for the present history of the Church and for my own pontificate. It is an encyclical that has the distinction of having been commemorated by solemn papal documents from its 40th anniversary to its 90th. It may be said that its path through history has been marked by other documents which paid tribute to it and applied it to the circumstances of the day. 2. In doing likewise for the 100th anniversary, in response to requests from many bishops, church institutions, and study centers, as well as business leaders and workers, both individually and as members of associations, I wish first and foremost to satisfy the debt of gratitude which the whole Church owes to this great Pope and his immortal document. 3. I also mean to show that the vital energies rising from that root have not been spent with the passing of the years, but rather have increased even more. This is evident from the various initiatives which have preceded and which are to accompany and follow the celebration, initiatives promoted by episcopal conferences, by international agencies, universities, and academic institutes, by professional associations, and by other institutions and individuals in many parts of the world. 2. The present encyclical is part of these celebrations, which are meant to thank God the origin of every good endowment and every perfect gift, Jas 1:17, for having used a document published a century ago by the See of Peter to achieve so much good and to radiate so much light in the Church and in the world. Although the commemoration at hand is meant to honor Rerum Novarum, it also honors those encyclicals and other documents of my predecessors which have helped to make Pope Leo's encyclical present and alive in history, thus constituting what would come to be called the Church's social doctrine, social teaching, or even social magisterium. The validity of this teaching has already been pointed out in two encyclicals published during my pontificate, Laborem Exercens on Human Work and Solicitudori Socialis, on current problems regarding the development of individuals and peoples. 4. 3. I now wish to propose a rereading of Pope Leo's encyclical by issuing an invitation to look back at the text itself in order to discover anew the richness of the fundamental principles which it formulated for dealing with the question of the condition of workers. But this is also an invitation to look around at the new things which surround us and in which we find ourselves caught up, very different from the new things which characterize the final decade of the last century. Finally, it is an invitation to look to the future, at a time when we can already glimpse the third millennium of the Christian era, so filled with uncertainties, but also with promises, uncertainties and promises which appeal to our imagination and creativity, and which reawaken our responsibility as disciples of the one teacher, cf. Matthew 23:8, to show the way, to proclaim the truth, and to communicate the life which is Christ, cf. John 14:6. A rereading of this kind will not only confirm the permanent value of such teaching, but will also manifest the true meaning of the Church's tradition which, being ever living and vital, builds upon the foundation laid by our fathers in the faith, and particularly upon what the apostles passed down to the Church. 5. In the name of Jesus Christ, who is her irreplaceable foundation, cf. 1 Corinthians 3:11. It was out of an awareness of his mission as the successor of Peter that Pope Leo XIII proposed to speak out, and Peter's successor today is moved by that same awareness. Like Pope Leo and the popes before and after him, I take my inspiration from the gospel image of the scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven, whom the Lord compares to a householder who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old, Matthew 13:52. The treasure is the great outpouring of the Church's tradition, which contains what is old, received and passed on from the very beginning, and which enables us to interpret the new things, in the midst of which the life of the Church and the world unfolds. Among the things which become old as a result of being incorporated into tradition, and which offer opportunities and material for enriching both tradition and the life of faith, there is the fruitful activity of many millions of people, who, spurred on by the social magisterium, have sought to make that teaching the inspiration for their involvement in the world, acting either as individuals or joined together in various groups, associations, and organizations. These people represent a great movement for the defense of the human person and the safeguarding of human dignity. Amid changing historical circumstances, this movement has contributed to the building up of a more just society, or at least to the curbing of injustice. The present encyclical seeks to show the fruitfulness of the principles enunciated by Leo XIII, which belong to the Church's doctrinal patrimony, and, as such, involve the exercise of her teaching authority. But pastoral solicitude also prompts me to propose an analysis of some events of recent history. It goes without saying that part of the responsibility of pastors is to give careful consideration to current events in order to discern the new requirements of evangelization. However, such an analysis is not meant to pass definitive judgments, since this does not fall per se within the magisterium's specific domain. Characteristics of Rerum Novarum. 4. Towards the end of the last century, the Church found herself facing an historical process which had already been taking place for some time, but which was by then reaching a critical point. The determining factor in this process was a combination of radical changes which had taken place in the political, economic and social fields, and in the areas of science and technology, to say nothing of the wide influence of the prevailing ideologies. In the sphere of politics, the result of these changes was a new conception of society and of the state, and consequently of authority itself. A traditional society was passing away, and another was beginning to be formed, one which brought the hope of new freedoms, but also the threat of new forms of injustice and servitude. In the sphere of economics, in which scientific discoveries and their practical application come together, new structures for the production of consumer goods had progressively taken shape. A new form of property had appeared, capital, and a new form of labor for wages, characterized by high rates of production which lacked a regard for sex, age, or family situation, and were determined solely by efficiency, with a view to increasing profits. In this way, labor became a commodity to be freely bought and sold on the market, its price determined by the law of supply and demand, without taking into account the bare minimum required for the support of the individual and his family. Moreover, the worker was not even sure of being able to sell his own commodity, continually threatened, as he was, by unemployment, which, in the absence of any kind of social security, meant the specter of death by starvation. The result of this transformation was a society divided into two classes, separated by a deep chasm. 6. This situation was linked to the marked change taking place in the political order already mentioned. Thus, the prevailing political theory of the time sought to promote total economic freedom by appropriate laws, or, conversely, by a deliberate lack of any intervention. At the same time, another conception of property and economic life was beginning to appear in an organized and often violent form, one which implied new political and social structure. At the height of this clash, when people finally began to realize fully the very grave injustice of social realities in many places, and the danger of a revolution fanned by ideals which were then called socialist, Pope Leo XIII intervened with a document which dealt in a systematic way with the condition of the workers. The encyclical had been preceded by others devoted to teachings of a political character, still others would appear later. 7. Here, particular mention must be made of the encyclical Libertas Prestantissimum, which called attention to the essential bond between human freedom and truth, so that freedom which refused to be bound to the truth would fall into arbitrariness and end up submitting itself to the vilest of passions, to the point of self-destruction. Indeed, what is the origin of all the evils to which Rerum Novarum wished to respond, if not a kind of freedom which, in the area of economic and social activity, cuts itself off from the truth about man? The Pope also drew inspiration from the teaching of his predecessors, as well as from the many documents issued by bishops, from scientific studies promoted by members of the laity, from the work of Catholic movements and associations, and from the Church's practical achievements in the social field during the second half of the 19th century. 5. The new things to which the Pope devoted his attention were anything but positive. The first paragraph of the encyclical describes in strong terms the new things, Rerum Novarum, which gave it its name, that the spirit of revolutionary change which has long been disturbing the nations of the world should have passed beyond the sphere of politics and made its influence felt in the related sphere of practical economics is not surprising. Progress in industry, the development of new trades, the changing relationship between employers and workers, the enormous wealth of a few as opposed to the poverty of the many, the increasing self-reliance of the workers, and their closer association with each other, as well as a notable decline in morality, all these elements have led to the conflict now taking place. 8. The Pope and the Church with him were confronted, as was the civil community, by a society which was torn by a conflict all the more harsh and inhumane, because it knew no rule or regulation. It was the conflict between capital and labor, or, as the encyclical puts it, the worker question. It is precisely about this conflict, in the very pointed terms in which it then appeared, that the Pope did not hesitate to speak. Here we find the first reflection for our times, as suggested by the encyclical. In the face of a conflict which set man against man, almost as if they were wolves, a conflict between the extremes of mere physical survival on the one side and opulence on the other, the Pope did not hesitate to intervene by virtue of his apostolic office, 9 that is, on the basis of the mission received from Jesus Christ himself to feed his lambs and tend his sheep, cf. John 21:15-17, and to bind and loose on earth for the kingdom of heaven, cf. Matthew 16:19. The Pope's intention was certainly to restore peace, and the present-day reader cannot fail to note his severe condemnation, in no uncertain terms, of the class struggle. 10. However, the Pope was very much aware that peace is built on the foundation of justice. What was essential to the encyclical was precisely its proclamation of the fundamental conditions for justice in the economic and social situation of the time. 11. In this way, Pope Leo XIII, in the footsteps of his predecessors, created a lasting paradigm for the Church. The Church, in fact, has something to say about specific human situations, both individual and communal, national and international. She formulates a genuine doctrine for these situations, a corpus which enables her to analyze social realities, to make judgments about them and to indicate directions to be taken for the just resolution of the problems involved. In Pope Leo XIII's time, such a concept of the Church's right and duty was far from being commonly admitted. Indeed, a twofold approach prevailed, one directed to this world and this life, to which faith ought to remain extraneous, the other directed towards a purely otherworldly salvation, which neither enlightens nor directs existence on earth. The Pope's approach in publishing Rerum Novarum gave the Church citizenship status, as it were, amid the changing realities of public life, and the standing would be more fully confirmed later on. In effect, to teach and to spread her social doctrine pertains to the Church's evangelizing mission, and is an essential part of the Christian message, since this doctrine points out the direct consequences of that message in the life of society and situates daily work and struggles for justice in the context of bearing witness to Christ the Savior. This doctrine is likewise a source of unity and peace in dealing with the conflicts which inevitably arise in social and economic life. Thus it is possible to meet these new situations without degrading the human person's transcendent dignity, either in oneself or in one's adversaries, and to direct those situations towards just solutions. Today, at a distance of 100 years, the validity of this approach affords me the opportunity to contribute to the development of Christian social doctrine, the new evangelization, which the modern world urgently needs, and which I have emphasized many times, must include among its essential elements a proclamation of the Church's social doctrine. As in the days of Pope Leo XIII, this doctrine is still suitable for indicating the right way to respond to the great challenges of today, when ideologies are being increasingly discredited. Now, as then, we need to repeat that there can be no genuine solution of the social question apart from the gospel, and that the new things can find in the gospel the context for their correct understanding and the proper moral perspective for judgment on them. 6. With the intention of shedding light on the conflict which had arisen between capital and labor, Pope Leo XIII affirmed the fundamental rights of workers. Indeed, the key to reading the encyclical is the dignity of the worker as such, and, for the same reason, the dignity of work, which is defined as follows: to exert oneself for the sake of procuring what is necessary for the various purposes of life, and first of all for self-preservation. 1-2 The Pope describes work as personal, inasmuch as the energy expended is bound up with the personality, and is the exclusive property of him who acts, and, furthermore, was given to him for his advantage. 1-3 Work thus belongs to the vocation of every person. Indeed, man expresses and fulfills himself by working. At the same time, work has a social dimension through its intimate relationship not only to the family, but also to the common good, since it may truly be said that it is only by the labor of working men that states grow rich. 1-4 These are themes that I have taken up and developed in my encyclical Labo Frem Exercens. 1-5 Another important principle is undoubtedly that of the right to private property. 1-6 The amount of space devoted to this subject in the encyclical shows the importance attached to it. The Pope is well aware that private property is not an absolute value, nor does he fail to proclaim the necessary complementary principles, such as the universal destination of the earth's goods. 1-7 On the other hand, it is certainly true that the type of private property which Leo XIII mainly considers is land ownership. 1-8 But this does not mean that the reasons adduced to safeguard private property, or to affirm the right to possess the things necessary for one's personal development, and the development of one's family, whatever the concrete form which that right may assume, are not still valid today. This is something which must be affirmed once more in the face of the changes we are witnessing in systems formerly dominated by collective ownership of the means of production, as well as in the face of the increasing instances of poverty, or, more precisely, of hindrances to private ownership in many parts of the world, including those where systems predominate which are based on an affirmation of the right to private property. As a result of these changes, and of the persistence of poverty, a deeper analysis of the problem is called for, an analysis which will be developed later in this document. 7. In close connection with the right to private property, Pope Leo XIII's encyclical also affirms other rights as inalienable and proper to the human person. Prominent among these, because of the space which the Pope devotes to it and the importance which he attaches to it, is the natural human right to form private associations. This means above all the right to establish professional associations of employers and workers, or of workers alone. 1-9 Here we find the reason for the Church's defense and approval of the establishment of what are commonly called trade unions, certainly not because of ideological prejudices, or in order to surrender to a class mentality, but because the right of association is a natural right of the human being, which therefore precedes his or her incorporation into political society. Indeed, the formation of unions cannot be prohibited by the state, because the state is bound to protect natural rights, not to destroy them, and if it forbids its citizens to form associations, it contradicts the very principle of its own existence. 2-0 Together with this right, which it must be stressed the Pope explicitly acknowledges as belonging to workers, or, using his own language, to the working class, the encyclical affirms just as clearly the right to the limitation of working hours, the right to legitimate rest, and the right of children and women 21 to be treated differently with regard to the type and duration of work. If we keep in mind what history tells us about the practices permitted, or at least not excluded by law regarding the way in which workers were employed, without any guarantees as to working hours, or the hygienic conditions of the workplace, or even regarding the age and sex of apprentices, we can appreciate the Pope's severe statement. It is neither just nor human so to grind men down with excessive labor as to stupefy their minds and wear out their bodies, and referring to the contract aimed at putting into effect labor relations of this sort, he affirms with greater precision that, in all agreements between employers and workers, there is always the condition expressed or understood that proper rest be allowed, proportionate to the wear and tear of one's strength. He then concludes, to agree in any other sense would be against what is right and just. 22.8. The Pope immediately adds another right which the worker has, as a person. This is the right to a just wage, which cannot be left to the free consent of the parties, so that the employer, having paid what was agreed upon, has done his part, and seemingly is not called upon to do anything beyond. 23. It was said at the time that the state does not have the power to intervene in the terms of these contracts, except to ensure the fulfillment of what had been explicitly agreed upon. This concept of relations between employers and employees, purely pragmatic and inspired by a thoroughgoing individualism, is severely censured in the encyclical as contrary to the twofold nature of work, as a personal and necessary reality. For if work as something personal belongs to the sphere of the individual's free use of his own abilities and energy, as something necessary it is governed by the grave obligation of every individual to ensure the preservation of life. It necessarily follows, the Pope concludes, that every individual has natural right to procure what is required to live, and the poor can procure that in no other way than by what they can earn through their work. 24. A workman's wages should be sufficient to enable him to support himself, his wife, and his children. If through necessity or fear of a worse evil the workman accepts harder conditions because an employer or contractor will afford no better, he is made the victim of force and injustice. 25. Would that these words, written at a time when what has been called unbridled capitalism was pressing forward, should not have to be repeated today with the same severity. Unfortunately, even today one finds instances of contracts between employers and employees which lack reference to the most elementary justice regarding the employment of children or women, working hours, the hygienic condition of the workplace, and fair pay. And this is the case, despite the international declarations and conventions on the subject 26, and the internal laws of states, the Pope attributed to the public authority the strict duty of providing properly for the welfare of the workers, because a failure to do so violates justice. Indeed, he did not hesitate to speak of distributive justice. 27.9. To these rights Pope Leo XIII adds another right regarding the condition of the working class, one which I wish to mention because of its importance, namely, the right to discharge freely one's religious duties. The Pope wished to proclaim this right within the context of the other rights and duties of workers, notwithstanding the general opinion, even in his day, that such questions pertained exclusively to an individual's private life. He affirms the need for Sunday rest so that people may turn their thoughts to heavenly things, and to the worship which they owe to Almighty God. 28. No one can take away this human right, which is based on a commandment. In the words of the Pope, no man may with impunity violate that human dignity which God himself treats with great reverence, and consequently, the state must guarantee to the worker the exercise of this freedom. 29. It would not be mistaken to see in this clear statement a springboard for the principle of the right to religious freedom, which was to become the subject of many solemn international declarations and conventions. 30. As well as of the Second Vatican Council's well-known declaration, and of my own repeated teaching. 31. In this regard, one may ask whether existing laws and the practice of industrialized societies effectively ensure in our own day the exercise of this basic right to Sunday rest. 10. Another important aspect, which has many applications to our own day, is the concept of the relationship between the state and its citizens. Rerum Novarum criticizes two social and economic systems, socialism and liberalism. The opening section, in which the right to private property is reaffirmed, is devoted to socialism. Liberalism is not the subject of a special section, but it is worth noting that criticisms of it are raised in the treatment of the duties of the state. 3. To the state cannot limit itself to favoring one portion of the citizens, namely the rich and prosperous, nor can it neglect the other, which clearly represents the majority of society. Otherwise, there would be a violation of that law of justice which ordains that every person should receive his due. When there is question of defending the rights of individuals, the defenseless and the poor have a claim to special consideration. The richer class has many ways of shielding itself, and stands less in need of help from the state, whereas the mass of the poor have no resources of their own to fall back on, and must chiefly depend on the assistance of the state. It is for this reason that wage earners, since they mostly belong to the latter class, should be specially cared for and protected by the government. 33. These passages are relevant today, especially in the face of the new forms of poverty in the world, and also because they are affirmations which do not depend on a specific notion of the state or on a particular political theory. Leo XIII is repeating an elementary principle of sound political organization, namely, the more that individuals are defenseless within a given society, the more they require the care and concern of others, and in particular the intervention of governmental authority. In this way, what we nowadays call the principle of solidarity, the validity of which both in the internal order of each nation and in the international order I have discussed in the encyclical Solidaritate Socialis, 34, is clearly seen to be one of the fundamental principles of the Christian view of social and political organization. This principle is frequently stated by Pope Leo XIII, who uses the term friendship, a concept already found in Greek philosophy. Pope Pius XI refers to it with the equally meaningful term social charity. Pope Paul VI, expanding the concept to cover the many modern aspects of the social question, speaks of a civilization of love. 35.11. Rereading the encyclical in the light of contemporary realities enables us to appreciate the Church's constant concern for and dedication to categories of people who are especially beloved to the Lord Jesus. The content of the text is an excellent testimony to the continuity within the Church of the so-called preferential option for the poor, an option which I defined as a special form of primacy in the exercise of Christian charity. 36. Pope Leo's encyclical on the condition of the workers is thus an encyclical on the poor and on the terrible conditions to which the new and often violent process of industrialization had reduced great multitudes of people. Today, in many parts of the world, similar processes of economic, social and political transformation are creating the same evils. If Pope Leo XIII calls upon the state to remedy the condition of the poor in accordance with justice, he does so because of his timely awareness that the state has the duty of watching over the common good and of ensuring that every sector of social life, not excluding the economic one, contributes to achieving that good while respecting the rightful autonomy of each sector. This should not, however, lead us to think that Pope Leo expected the state to solve every social problem. On the contrary, he frequently insists on necessary limits to the state's intervention and on its instrumental character, inasmuch as the individual, the family, and society are prior to the state, and inasmuch as the state exists in order to protect their rights and not stifle them. 37. The relevance of these reflections for our own day is inescapable. It will be useful to return later to this important subject of the limits inherent in the nature of the state. For now, the points which have been emphasized, certainly not the only ones in the encyclical, are situated in continuity with the Church's social teaching, and in the light of a sound view of private property, work, the economic process, the reality of the state, and, above all, of man himself. Other themes will be mentioned later when we examine certain aspects of the contemporary situation. From this point forward, it will be necessary to keep in mind that the main thread, and, in a certain sense, the guiding principle of Pope Leo's encyclical, and of all of the Church's social doctrine, is a correct view of the human person, and of his unique value, inasmuch as man is the only creature on earth which God willed for itself. 38. God has imprinted his own image and likeness on man, cf. Genesis 1:26, conferring upon him an incomparable dignity, as the encyclical frequently insists. In effect, beyond the rights which man acquires by his own work, there exist rights which do not correspond to any work he performs, but which flow from his essential dignity as a person. 2. Towards dhenew things, of today. 12. The commemoration of Rerum Novarum would be incomplete unless reference were also made to the situation of the world today. The document lends itself to such a reference because the historical picture and the prognosis which it suggests have proved to be surprisingly accurate in the light of what has happened since then. This is especially confirmed by the events which took place near the end of 1989, and at the beginning of 1990. These events, and the radical transformations which followed, can only be explained by the preceding situations which, to a certain extent, crystallized or institutionalized Leo XIII's predictions, and the increasingly disturbing signs noted by his successors. Pope Leo foresaw the negative consequences, political, social and economic, of the social order proposed by socialism, which at that time was still only a social philosophy, and not yet a fully structured movement. It may seem surprising that socialism appeared at the beginning of the Pope's critique of solutions to the question of the working class, at a time when socialism was not yet in the form of a strong and powerful state, with all the resources which that implies, as was later to happen. However, he correctly judged the danger posed to the masses by the attractive presentation of this simple and radical solution to the question of the working class, of the time, all the more so when one considers the terrible situation of injustice in which the working classes of the recently industrialized nations found themselves. Two things must be emphasized here. First, the great clarity in perceiving, in all its harshness, the actual condition of the working classmen, women, and children. Secondly, equal clarity in recognizing the evil of a solution which, by appearing to reverse the positions of the poor and the rich, was in reality detrimental to the very people whom it was meant to help. The remedy would prove worse than the sickness. By defining the nature of the socialism of his day as the suppression of private property, Leo XIII arrived at the crux of the problem. His words deserve to be reread attentively. To remedy these wrongs, the unjust distribution of wealth, and the poverty of the workers, the socialists encourage the poor man's envy of the rich and strive to do away with private property, contending that individual possessions should become the common property of all. But their contentions are so clearly powerless to end the controversy that, were they carried into effect, the working man himself would be among the first to suffer. They are moreover emphatically unjust, for they would rob the lawful possessor, distort the functions of the state, and create utter confusion in the community. 39. The evils caused by the setting up of this type of socialism as a state system, what would later be called real socialism, could not be better expressed. 13. Continuing our reflections, and referring also to what has been said in the encyclicals Laborem Exercens and Solicitatoriae Socialis, we have to add that the fundamental error of socialism is anthropological in nature. Socialism considers the individual person simply as an element, a molecule within the social organism, so that the good of the individual is completely subordinated to the functioning of the socio-economic mechanism. Socialism likewise maintains that the good of the individual can be realized without reference to his free choice, to the unique and exclusive responsibility which he exercises in the face of good or evil. Man is thus reduced to a series of social relationships, and the concept of the person as the autonomous subject of moral decision disappears, the very subject whose decisions build the social order. From this mistaken conception of the person there arise both a distortion of law, which defines the sphere of the exercise of freedom, and an opposition to private property. A person who is deprived of something he can call his own, and of the possibility of earning a living through his own initiative, comes to depend on the social machine, and on those who control it. This makes it much more difficult for him to recognize his dignity as a person, and hinders progress towards the building up of an authentic human community. In contrast, from the Christian vision of the human person there necessarily follows a correct picture of society. According to Rerum Novarum, and the whole social doctrine of the Church, the social nature of man is not completely fulfilled in the state, but is realized in various intermediary groups, beginning with the family, and including economic, social, political and cultural groups which stem from human nature itself, and have their own autonomy, always with a view to the common good. This is what I have called the subjectivity of society, which, together with the subjectivity of the individual, was cancelled out by real socialism. 40. If we then inquire as to the source of this mistaken concept of the nature of the person and the subjectivity of society, we must reply that its first cause is atheism. It is by responding to the call of God contained in the being of things that man becomes aware of his transcendent dignity. Every individual must give this response, which constitutes the apex of his humanity, and no social mechanism or collective subject can substitute for it. The denial of God deprives the person of his foundation, and consequently leads to a reorganization of the social order without reference to the person's dignity and responsibility. The atheism of which we are speaking is also closely connected with the rationalism of the Enlightenment, which views human and social reality in a mechanistic way. Thus there is a denial of the supreme insight concerning man's true greatness, his transcendence in respect to earthly realities, the contradiction in his heart between the desire for the fullness of what is good and his own inability to obtain it, and, above all, the need for salvation which results from this situation. 14. From the same atheistic source, socialism also derives its choice of the means of action condemned in Rerum Novarum, namely, class struggle. The Pope does not, of course, intend to condemn every possible form of social conflict. The Church is well aware that in the course of history conflicts of interest between different social groups inevitably arise, and that in the face of such conflicts Christians must often take a position, honestly and decisively. The encyclical Laudato Si exercens moreover clearly recognized the positive role of conflict when it takes the form of a struggle for social justice. 41 Quadragesimo anno had already stated that, if a class struggle abstains from enmities and mutual hatred, it gradually changes into an honest discussion of differences founded on a desire for justice. 42. However, what is condemned in class struggle is the idea that conflict is not restrained by ethical or juridical considerations, or by respect for the dignity of others, and consequently of oneself. Reasonable compromise is thus excluded, and what is pursued is not the general good of society, but a partisan interest which replaces the common good, and sets out to destroy whatever stands in its way. In a word, it is a question of transferring to the sphere of internal conflict between social groups the doctrine of total war, which the militarism and imperialism of that time brought to bear on international relations. As a result of this doctrine, the search for a proper balance between the interests of the various nations was replaced by attempts to impose the absolute domination of one's own side through the destruction of the other side's capacity to resist, using every possible means, not excluding the use of lies, terror tactics against citizens, and weapons of utter destruction which precisely in those years were beginning to be designed. Therefore class struggle in the Marxist sense and militarism have the same root, namely, atheism and contempt for the human person, which place the principle of force above that of reason and law. 15. Rerum novarum is opposed to state control of the means of production, which would reduce every citizen to being a cog in the state machine. It is no less forceful in criticizing a concept of the state which completely excludes the economic sector from the state's range of interest and action. There is certainly a legitimate sphere of autonomy in economic life which the state should not enter. The state, however, has the task of determining the juridical framework within which economic affairs are to be conducted, and thus of safeguarding the prerequisites of a free economy, which presumes a certain equality between the parties, such that one party would not be so powerful as practically to reduce the other to subservience. 43. In this regard, Rerum Novarum points the way to just reforms which can restore dignity to work as the free activity of man. These reforms imply that society and the state will both assume responsibility, especially for protecting the worker from the nightmare of unemployment. Historically, this has happened in two converging ways, either through economic policies aimed at ensuring balanced growth and full employment, or through unemployment insurance and retraining programs capable of ensuring a smooth transfer of workers from crisis sectors to those in expansion. Furthermore, society and the state must ensure wage levels adequate for the maintenance of the worker and his family, including a certain amount for savings. This requires a continuous effort to improve workers' training and capability so that their work will be more skilled and productive, as well as careful controls and adequate legislative measures to block shameful forms of exploitation, especially to the disadvantage of the most vulnerable workers, of immigrants, and of those on the margins of society. The role of trade unions in negotiating minimum salaries and working conditions is decisive in this area. Finally, humane working hours and adequate free time need to be guaranteed, as well as the right to express one's own personality at the workplace without suffering any affront to one's conscience or personal dignity. This is the place to mention once more the role of trade unions, not only in negotiating contracts, but also as places where workers can express themselves. They serve the development of an authentic culture of work and help workers to share in a fully human way in the life of their place of employment. 44. The state must contribute to the achievement of these goals both directly and indirectly. Indirectly and according to the principle of subsidiarity, by creating favorable conditions for the free exercise of economic activity, which will lead to abundant opportunities for employment and sources of wealth, directly and according to the principle of solidarity, by defending the weakest, by placing certain limits on the autonomy of the parties who determine working conditions, and by ensuring in every case the necessary minimum support for the unemployed worker. 45. The encyclical and the related social teaching of the Church had far-reaching influence in the years bridging the 19th and 20th centuries. This influence is evident in the numerous reforms which were introduced in the areas of social security, pensions, health insurance, and compensation in the case of accidents, within the framework of greater respect for the rights of workers. 46. 16. These reforms were carried out in part by states, but in the struggle to achieve them the role of the workers' movement was an important one. This movement, which began as a response of moral conscience to unjust and harmful situations, conducted widespread campaign for reform, far removed from vague ideology, and closer to the daily needs of workers. In this context, its efforts were often joined to those of Christians in order to improve workers' living conditions. Later on, this movement was dominated to a certain extent by the Marxist ideology, against which Rerum Novarum had spoken. These same reforms were also partly the result of an open process by which society organized itself through the establishment of effective instruments of solidarity, which were capable of sustaining an economic growth more respectful of the values of the person. Here we should remember the numerous efforts to which Christians made a notable contribution in establishing producers, consumers, and credit cooperatives, in promoting general education and professional training, in experimenting with various forms of participation in the life of the workplace and in the life of society in general. Thus, as we look at the past, there is good reason to thank God that the great encyclical was not without an echo in human hearts, and indeed led to a generous response on the practical level. Still, we must acknowledge that its prophetic message was not fully accepted by people at the time. Precisely for this reason there ensued some very serious tragedies. 17. Reading the encyclical within the context of Pope Leo's whole magisterium. 47. We see how it points essentially to the socio-economic consequences of an error which has even greater implications. As has been mentioned, this error consists in an understanding of human freedom which detaches it from obedience to the truth, and consequently from the duty to respect the rights of others. The essence of freedom then becomes self-love carried to the point of contempt for God and neighbor, a self-love which leads to an unbridled affirmation of self-interest, and which refuses to be limited by any demand of justice. 48. This very error had extreme consequences in the tragic series of wars which ravaged Europe and the world between 1914 and 1945. Some of these resulted from militarism and exaggerated nationalism, and from related forms of totalitarianism. Some derived from the class struggle. Still others were civil wars or wars of an ideological nature, without the terrible burden of hatred and resentment which had built up as a result of so many injustices both on the international level and within individual states. Such cruel wars would not have been possible, in which great nations invested their energies, and in which there was no hesitation to violate the most sacred human rights, with the extermination of entire peoples and social groups being planned and carried out. Here we recall the Jewish people in particular, whose terrible fate has become a symbol of the aberration of which man is capable when he turns against God. However, it is only when hatred and injustice are sanctioned and organized by the ideologies based on them, rather than on the truth about man, that they take possession of entire nations and drive them to act. 49. Rerum Novarum opposed ideologies of hatred and showed how violence and resentment could be overcome by justice. May the memory of those terrible events guide the actions of everyone, particularly the leaders of nations in our own time, when other forms of injustice are fueling new hatreds, and when new ideologies which exalt violence are appearing on the horizon. 18. While it is true that since 1945 weapons have been silent on the European continent, it must be remembered that true peace is never simply the result of military victory, but rather implies both the removal of the causes of war and genuine reconciliation between peoples. For many years there has been in Europe and the world a situation of non-war rather than genuine peace. Half of the continent fell under the domination of a communist dictatorship, while the other half organized itself in defense against this threat. Many peoples lost the ability to control their own destiny and were enclosed within the suffocating boundaries of an empire in which efforts were made to destroy their historical memory and the centuries-old roots of their culture. As a result of this violent division of Europe, enormous masses of people were compelled to leave their homeland or were forcibly deported. An insane arms race swallowed up the resources needed for the development of national economies and for assistance to the less developed nations. Scientific and technological progress, which should have contributed to man's well-being, was transformed into an instrument of war. Science and technology were directed to the production of ever more efficient and destructive weapons. Meanwhile, an ideology, a perversion of authentic philosophy, was called upon to provide doctrinal justification for the new war, and this war was not simply expected and prepared for, but was actually fought with enormous bloodshed in various parts of the world. The logic of power blocks or empires, denounced in various church documents, and recently in the encyclical Solicitatore Socialis, 50 led to a situation in which controversies and disagreements among Third World countries were systematically aggravated and exploited in order to create difficulties for the adversary. Extremist groups, seeking to resolve such controversies through the use of arms, found ready political and military support, and were equipped and trained for war. Those who tried to find peaceful and humane solutions, with respect for the legitimate interests of all parties, remained isolated, and often fell victim to their opponents. In addition, the precariousness of the peace which followed the Second World War was one of the principal causes of the militarization of many Third World countries, and the fratricidal conflicts which afflicted them, as well as of the spread of terrorism, and of increasingly barbaric means of political and military conflict.